CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 153, with Dr. Satya Reddy. The challenge of building a practice and balancing a family life. That's something that's really not that easy. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Satya Reddy from the New Orleans area. He's a cataract, anterior segment, corneal surgeon, and we have a lot of fun things to talk about, which I'm sure you're going to enjoy. Satya, welcome to my podcast, buddy.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Adai, for having me on.
Yeah, we've known each other a long time, and we have a lot of very similar philosophies.
We do. We've known each other a really long time.
Now, tell me a little bit about what your specialty is. So your cataract, refractive, anterior segment, cornea, what do you love the most?
Basically, I do a lot of complex anterior segment work, a lot of cornea work, lens exchanges, iris reconstructions, the complex anterior segment pathology.
So, and you're like me, where you just don't get too excited about dry eye disease. I mean, it's important, don't get me wrong, but it just it's not my passion.
Dry eye is definitely not my passion. I live in an area that has 80% humidity, probably for a reason. So we don't have as much dry eye down here. And it's just, it's definitely not a passion of mine. I like to try to avoid those when possible.
Yeah, in fact, you know, that's a good point, actually. So they're in the New Orleans area, where you're basically in lowland, marsh area, very low altitude and then very high humidity, very different than LA, where here I'm like constantly 10% humidity year round.
Exactly. Here, dry eye is a very different disease pathology than it is in like LA, for example, where you actually have dry air. So here, all of a sudden, come December, January, when the weather cools down and we actually have actual dry air, then everybody gets a lot more dry eye. But overall, it's a very different disease here than elsewhere.
Right. Plus, you live in an area where there's just a lot of pathology. I'm sometimes surprised at the amazing difficulty of the cases you get.
There are, again, as a referral center, you get a lot of, I think there's a lot of pathology everywhere. It's sure. Just here, we get to see it. And again, as a referral center, you get to see a lot more pathology when people send you the cases. So,
right. How'd you get involved with the prosthetic iris devices? So I don't do those at all. And there are only a few select surgeons kind of throughout the U.S. who do them. How'd you get involved in that?
So back when I was doing my fellowship in Chicago, Joel Sugar, he had told me about how Mortra was had one available in the U.S., but we had to do you had to petition the FDA. And then back in 2006 or 7, when I first started practice, the Mortra device became available if we were part of their study protocol. So I got involved with the prosthetic iris with that device back in 2007. And then once the human optics came out, I transitioned over to that. I think the Mortra device left the market a few years afterwards. And then the human optics device came available due to Mike Snyder's work, and I've been involved with that ever since.
Yeah, so for those who know, the Mortra device looked like kind of blades of a fan on basically like a CTR, and when you put it in the eyes and you compress that, then the blades of the fan kind of close the gaps, and then you have now a small pupil.
There was that one, and there was the other one they had, which is really, really just a large IOL. It was like a 12-millimeter IOL.
How do you get that? Like, big incision?
That was a huge incision. Probably an old extra cap style incision, 12 millimeters across. It was a massive incision. 10 millimeters, maybe. It was many years since I did that.
Yeah, we had Mike Snyder on the podcast. He talked a lot about the prosthetic devices. Now the human optics one, which is kind of painted to match the other eye of the patient. And those look like probably a much better option.
They're a much better option, and they're very impressive once they're in place, how well they look.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, satisfaction is extremely high with those.
Right, because the cosmetic appearance compared to the other eye is like pretty darn equal.
Exactly.
Yeah, those are really neat devices. Now, obviously, you need to have great surgical skills here. And I know you have very graciously volunteered your time for many years at the major ophthalmic meetings to teach these microsurgical techniques here. Tell me more about that.
Well, so hey, again, we all like to teach and share our knowledge, right, and share our experience so others can learn what we can do and get more people just involved in these various surgical techniques. So I, as you know, over 10 years now, I've been teaching courses at the Academy and ASCRS on suturing techniques and complex surgeries, iris repair techniques, scleral fixation of lenses. So
I think those are great courses, obviously, to learn from, but also even to teach at, because I've had ophthalmologists come up to me, no joke, 15, 20 years later, and say, hey, way back when at this meeting, we did a wet lab together, and you taught me this, that, the other. Do you remember it? I'm like, maybe. And then, you know what, it was so instrumental to me. It gave me such good hope. And like, that's, that person now is a way better surgeon than me.
I think also, as we do these and teach, we also learn little techniques too, because we can pick up from our students what might make their life easier too. And then we pick up those techniques ourselves and can incorporate into our own practice. Right. So as teachers, we learn as well each time.
Yeah, there's a saying, if you really want to know a subject well, teach it.
It's very true. Yes. Yes.
Very true. Now, tell me about more kind of these tough cases that you do besides just the artificial iris. So you're doing a lot of IOL exchange. You do like scleral fixation of IOLs.
I do scleral fixation of lenses. I over the years, I've transitioned from both just doing Gore-Tex fixation to now my go-to technique is the interscleral haptic fixation, the Yamane technique.
Remember, I met Shin Yamane at a meeting, and he says, Uday, cataract coach, it's not Yamane, it's Yamane. So now I say Yamane.
I remember when that Yamane technique was shown at the ASCRS meeting, and the whole audience just kind of looked, and it was like an aha moment, saying, wow, this really, it was a complete game changer, scleral fixation. And now with the availability of like the LAL, the light adjustable lens, we can do a scleral fixation and really nail refractive targets that was not quite as easy to do beforehand.
Right.
With other techniques.
Right. With a standard three-piece lens, where it sits, the effective lens position with Yamane interscleral haptic fixation is kind of hard to predict exactly.
Exactly. And sometimes you can get some subtle tilt as well. And then, of course, if a patient has pre-existing astigmatism, you're limited how much you could have fixed with just corneal surgery and with LRIs. So that's really allowed really to fine-tune precision vision for these patients.
So I think that basically almost every anterior segment surgeon, cataract surgeon, can learn to do Yamane. So what are your pearls to help? Let's say I'm a doctor in the community. I've really never done one. I've seen a lot of videos. It looks kind of cool. I've got an appropriate patient coming up. What do I do? How do I do this?
Well, first of all, I think first step for any type of complex anterior segment surgery for the first-time surgeon is practice in a wet lab. Practice, definitely have to practice in a wet lab. And then reality is the Yamane technique, it looks simple in experienced hands, but there's definitely a steep learning curve. And it can be very frustrating, especially if they're operating on a case, and if the surgeon isn't used to either doing posterior infusion or anterior infusion to maintain chamber stability. It's really critical for doing those steps.
Right, and that's actually a very important point. So you're much better off having constant infusion, whether it's an AC maintainer or pars plana trocar, so that you don't have collapse of the eye. You have a lot of more stability. Doing it without those is far more difficult.
It's a risk. You put the patient at risk at that point, because if you lose pressure in the eye, especially if it's a post vitrectomy eye, then you really can't do it without infusion.
Post vitrectomy eye for sure.
But even if they're not post vitrectomy, you still have vitreous. You can have vitreous prolapse. So I think it's really critical to have infusion to maintain chamber stability.
So let's say I got a patient. Talk me through this. I've never done Yamane, but I practice. I've done the wet lab. And I got a patient now with just really essentially no Zyner support. I did the IOL, the cataract removal. I didn't put an IOL in because it was too bad. Now I'm coming back a week or two or 3 weeks later now to do a secondary IOL.
Uh-huh.
What are my steps? So the patient's aphakic with a kind of capsular bag that's 80%, 90% detached. Now what?
Okay. Well, the first step is landmarks. You have to make your landmarks, figure out what your approach is going to be. Where do you sit? Are you a temporal surgeon or your superior surgeon? You really have to kind of sit down and plan this even in the OR or before you know OR. Every patient has different anatomy. We have to watch out for the deep brows, nose prominence of the bridge, because you're going to have your main incision. Then you also have your 230 gauge needles. You're going transscleral. And you have to make sure the anatomy of the patient's not going to impinge your ability to maneuver. So it's really critical for that. And then you have to have the right tools and equipment. A pair of micro forceps like the MST forceps to have, so you can manipulate in the eye, make sure you have the right, making sure you have all the right equipment for that. And then also you have to take, again, anytime you're doing new techniques, plan ahead of time and talk to the scrub tech. Not on the day of, but preferably the previous OR day you're there. At the end of your day, sit down with the scrub tech and say, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. Draw it out. Explain it step by step, so your scrub tech and your assistants are ready to do it. Because otherwise, if they're not ready to help you, you're going to struggle. And I think the key for any complex anterior segment surgery, even when things you routine, what you may routinely do, like Irish construction. Now, I will still draw it out to on the dry erase board with the scrub tech, say, hey, listen, here's the case we're going to do next. Here's the steps we're going to be doing. So be prepared. And if something goes sideways, I might ask for different instruments. So that way the scrub tech is prepared to handle whatever may come up also. And that reduces their anxiety. So it's really critical to talk to teach and educate your scrub tech and prep them for anything complex.
That's actually a great, great approach. I do something very similar. I do two pieces of paper, which I do ahead of time. On one of them, I make a list of all possible supplies I will need. And I, by the way, I print this out in like large 22 or 24 point font so that everyone can just read it very easily. And the other paper is, for me, it's kind of my recipe. Step one, step two, step three, step four. And I kind of go through a list of here are the things that I want to do in this order. So my two sheets are, again, number one sheet is here are all the potential supplies I will need today. Please have them available in the room. And number two is here's my kind of game plan and steps that I want to do today. And then everyone's on the same page.
Exactly. That way the circulator knows, the scrub tech knows, everybody understands what's going to happen, including your sutures you may need, other needles, anything else. And that's a critical part of any complex surgery. We have to help help the team help us.
Yeah. And then I love having my scrub tech on board. I got a great scrub tech who's much smarter than I ever was. And will sometimes say to me, you know, after working together for 10 years and 10,000, 20,000 cases, will say to me, doctor, do you want this instrument right now? Which is her way of saying, like, what are you doing? You need this.
I know. Having a scrub tech who understands your nuances and can see what you're about to do before you do it.
Yeah.
It's really critical having a scrub. And that's teamwork, right? That comes from our training the scrub techs to understand us and to explain why we do what we do, so they have a better appreciation for it also.
Yeah, the teamwork, I think, is really the key. And for these also, I also stack the odds in my favor. I'm doing at least a peribulbar block, if not like a retrobulbar subtenons block. I want a great block. Do not try this topical.
Oh, no, definitely not. Definitely. Topical works for cataracts. But for any of these complex repairs, definitely I do subtenons block on all of them. Because with the subtenons block, I can do it in the OR. With the retrobulbar, it still takes more time. But subtenons, I can do a little nick in the conjunctiva and pass the cannula, and you can get a block that works.
So. And I do a mixture of, for the subtenons, I'll do 560 Cs. Half of it will be 2% Lido without epi. Half of it will be 0.75 Marcaine or bupivacaine. And I'll do them both because I want that long-acting anesthesia too.
I usually do lidocaine with epinephrine. If it's going to be a longer case, like with a corneal transplant as well, then I'll add in the Marcaine. But I'll say I usually do it right in the inside corner. Just put a little down inside corner. And so.
Yeah, I think that's an important way of doing it. Now, how much of an antivitrectomy do we need to do on these cases?
I don't know if there's how do you answer how much? We have to do enough until there's not vitreous in there, until there's hardly vitreous in that space, right? So I do prefer doing a pars plana versus going through the anterior limbal wound.
Okay.
So, now I'll use that. Usually on these cases, I'll keep my infusion anteriorly, and then I do the vitrectomy portion from the pars plana.
So AC maintainer basically at the limbus with infusion kind of at a moderate level, low level, and then a pars plana trocar to do the vitrectomy, maybe a little wisp of triamcinolone to kind of stay and see where you're at?
Sometimes. When triamcinolone was readily available, I used to use it more. Now we have to rinse it, of course, so can use it. So I use it less frequently.
It is
a great adjunct.
Yeah, I want to see the vitreous, so I use triamcinolone every time. And you know what? There's a good video on cataractcoach.com where I show you exactly how to clean, get the regular catalog in the vial that has preservative. I show you how to filter it. I show you the exact filter I use, the syringe I use, everything I do. I show you everything to end up with basically nice catalog that's suspended in BSS without all that preservative.
Yeah, that's I need to show that video to my scrub tech actually.
You know what's funny? I make it myself though before the case. I guess I can show it to my staff to do it. I just do it myself. I want to keep it as sterile as possible. I'm so OCD. I want to keep it like sterile as possible. And like, I do it myself. But yeah, definitely I think triamcinolone is helpful. But I think there were some studies that showed if you didn't do enough of an anterior vitrectomy, that there was a pretty reasonably high rate of vitreous entrapment within the haptics, and the patients ended up getting a high rate. I think it was like 15% of CME, cystoid macular edema,
for vitreous. Again, I think that is important. There, so you definitely need a vitrectomy. Trying to do it without doing a vitrectomy can get you in trouble. Definitely get you in trouble.
Right. Yeah. And then too is actually, if you're doing these, and obviously you've seen the videos online, is to really mark very carefully so that you have your entry sites for the sclera 180 apart.
That's absolutely critical. And to make sure that the tunnels are about the same length, because I see mistakes where patients come in, they've got tilt or decentration. Again, a lot of that comes down to planning and marking and planning ahead of time. And I think part of that comes down to when surgeons get in and you look at the patient. I've seen these where the patient, there's some decentration, and look at the patient and maybe their anatomy, they have a deeper brow, or this is where the surgeon might not have taken into account anatomic factors that's going to limit the maneuverability in the eye. So then you might have, right. I usually do it with a 0 and 180 degrees, but I'll sometimes move that around based, again, brow, nasal bridge, however exposure looks. So
no, I think that's a super important point, because you want to get that lens evenly spaced in the eye, well centered, but also no tilt in it.
No tilt. Yeah, tilt is key.
And that's not easy. Yeah, but you're right. That's a surgery that looks much easier than it actually is.
So it's definitely got a steep learning curve.
Is there a pearl you have for ensuring that the flange, the burned end or the melted end of the haptic, doesn't expose through the conjunctiva later? How do we ensure that?
Again, I think this is similar to how the retina surgeons put their trocars in, right? We just kind of, as we put the initial 30-gauge TSK needle transscleral, grab the conch and then maneuver the conch to not enter the same point where the hub of the flange is going to be. Mm. So you have unadulterated conch there.
Right. Another thing too is importance of, like, as we're talking now, is of learning stuff that you didn't learn in your training. In your fellowship, no one taught you this. It didn't exist.
That's true. And I think that's key for all surgeons, right? To keep learning. It didn't exist. Absolutely. This didn't exist. DMEG didn't exist. There's all sorts of techniques that didn't exist for it. Like surgeons who are senior to us, right? They had to learn transition from extra caps to phacos, then transition the phacos to newer technologies. Vitrectomies, that's changed, right? They're doing cataract surgery with the Ruckert capsules. I'm sure vitrectomies were very different in the late 90s and early 2000s before I trained.
That's my era. When I finished residency 2000, they were doing 20-gauge partial plane vitrectomy. And for treatment of macular degeneration, they were trying to attempt macular translocation surgery. And it didn't work out so hot. But you're right. Things just keep advancing. Right. That's an important thing, is to kind of keep up with that. That's for sure.
To keep our skills up and keep learning new techniques, because the techniques keep changing, right? And it's the same in any industry, not just in ophthalmology or medicine. No, but the technology does advance in all industries. So I have to keep learning.
And so you transitioned from doing, I guess, for cornea stuff, a lot of DSEC, to more DMEC. When are we going to transition from DMEC to either, as Dr. Agarwal says, PDEC, or are we just going to skip right to injection of endothelial cells?
The injection, the technology looks really interesting and innovative. And save a trip to the OR, of course, and it can do it in the office. The recent data looks really interesting, and I think it's a matter of time before we start transitioning into that. It may take a while, and of course, the key there, I really think, is going to be payers, if insurance is willing to cover it. Mm. Because think about our Fuchs patients. They are old. A lot of them can be older, and especially patients who need repeated surgeries, those who have glaucoma patients with tube shunts, they need repeated surgeries every 3 to 5 years for successful endothelial surgery, because the grafts don't last. So in those patients, imagine being able to inject, say, stay face down, and maybe just have to do that every 2, 3, 4 years. A lot easier than taking them to the operating room repeatedly. So yeah, it's a matter of time till we transition there.
If you don't know what we're talking about, basically it's these new advances, but they're doing, I guess, now more so in Japan than anywhere else.
I think Japan's approved and covered now, right?
Yeah, you're injecting endothelial cells into the anterior chamber, having the patient then basically go face down for 3 hours, and you're done.
Yeah. And then... And I think in Bascom Palmer, they showed that they were adding ferrous material to the cells, injecting the patient's eye, then having the patient put a magnet for 3 hours.
Oh, that is so smart.
Yeah, and that way they don't have to worry about positioning. Just wear a magnet for half a day, and then the cells attach.
That is
I'm always amazed at how smart people are in ophthalmology. And to be frank, I, on a weekly basis, feel like I'm a dumbo in ophthalmology. I mean, people are so smart. Okay. Wow. That's brilliant.
I think it's a matter of time until, you know, once payers start covering it, we can start seeing a lot more of that. So right. Is everything right?
Yeah, that's one of the challenges. I mean, speaking of payers, I mean, that's like kind of you live and die by that sword in private practice.
Of course, right. Yeah, you know that too. So
yeah. Tell me a little about your private practice.
So I started this practice in Louisiana in 2009 and moved down here, found office space, threw up a shingle and started a practice, decided I'm going to be a cornea referral specialist. And started knocking on doors, shaking hands, and started my practice in Covington, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans, about a half an hour outside downtown New Orleans. And then in 2021, one of my colleagues who had developed a good relationship, he decided to transition out as he was getting older. And I expanded my practice to Slidell, which was a general ophthalmology practice. And then I ended up with a two-location practice, which is a general ophthalmology in Slidell. Covington was more cornea referral based. And over time, the Slidell practice has evolved to have more referral base as well for cornea and anterior segment.
Right. When I talk to young ophthalmologists, I always tell them, the world is your oyster. You can do anything you want. If you want to work for academia, do it. If you want to work for a big group, do it. If you want to work for private equity, do it. But if you want to start a private practice, you can actually do it. I promise you, I am not that smart, and I did it.
I think private practice absolutely can be done. And I talked to young ophthalmologists about that. The beauty of having your own private practice, you have a lot of control over your life, and you can fashion the practice to be what exactly you want it to be. There are challenges, and they're definitely like any startup business, right? But we're lucky that we can do a startup business, and I would argue it's easier to start up a private practice in medicine than it would be in many other industries, especially retail industries.
Oh, right.
Or restaurants.
Right.
And those guys do it all the time.
Right, yeah, you look at restaurants where they like get some numbers like, okay, 80% of new restaurants fail. Some of crazy.
Course. Yeah.
What's the percent of new ophthalmology private practices that fail? I would argue it's low single digits.
I would say very few. Very few.
I know one I can think of. One.
So, I mean, I can't think of the ones that have failed early on. I know the ones that fail later on, say mid-career or so, because of various factors, maybe not watching staff or other problems, but from a business model, I can't think of any that we fail in the first year or two.
I mean, hello, people. Hello, fellow ophthalmologists. There's a reason why private equity wants to buy into ophthalmology. Hello, do the math.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, no, I think it's still a very viable option. It's something that's certainly strong. If you have an inkling, please pursue it. I bet you'll surprise yourself.
There's a lot of fear factor from young ophthalmologists, but absolutely, it can be done. Sometimes you need some mentorship, talk to others in the area. And again, this is where young ophthalmologists can really gain by going to meetings and chatting. These are the discussions you have when you're walking around the exhibit hall, right? This is not when you go to lectures in the podium that talk about it. When you're walking around the exhibit hall, you can find senior ophthalmologists and say, hey, how did you make your private practice work?
Right.
And that's where going to meetings in person has value as opposed to just watching virtual meetings.
For sure. Now tell me, you have two practice locations where are a little different. One is very like referral, super specialized. One's that as well as the big general ophthalmology. What's the differentiator between the two? How do you, a general practice versus a more ultra specialized practice?
Well, again, the specialized practice is how it started and it's grown. And in the general practice, they had a more of a regular patient base. Because in my specialty practice, those patients get referred in, I fix their problems, and obviously I send them back out to the referring ophthalmologists and optometrists. The other practice is a more of a general practice, and there we do general eye care. We have an optical, we do glasses, contacts, everything. So it's they're about a half an hour apart, but since that practice was established and has been there for about 30 years, it's just carries on. So,
right, and another advantage that some people don't realize is that when you're your own boss, there's a good and bad. The good is you can make your own schedule. You can do what you want. You can travel. You can take time off to enjoy life, enjoy spending time with your kids. The downside, though, is when you take time off, there is a substantial penalty. And sometimes I am my own toughest critic. I'm my own toughest boss. I'm the world's meanest boss to myself.
Agreed. That's a challenge of private practice, right? Because we're not there. We still have all our staff are still there. So it is that navigation of saying, all right, if you're going to take 2 hours off here, know what's going to happen in the office, or 2 days off or 2 weeks off. So it is a challenge of managing it, but it's manageable.
So yeah, and I think it's important to do that. So one of the things we were talking about recently was you got to like carve out time to enjoy your life now. Don't just say, I'm going to wait until I'm retired at age 70 something and then I'll enjoy.
That's a big thing I see. If you talk to most physicians, especially senior physicians, almost all of them say, I wish I did more of something when I was younger. Right. I wish I did more of something. And I think it's key that when you talk to so many physicians and almost all of them say, when I was younger, I wish I did something, that's a lesson for us to do it when we're younger. And take time off, pursue our passions when we're younger, rather than waiting until we're older.
Absolutely. I never had a more senior ophthalmologist tell me, you know, I regret that I didn't work hard enough. I didn't do more work and more hours of surgery and more. No one ever says that.
Nobody ever says that, right? And nobody ever says, "Oh, I wish I retired." No, nobody ever says, "I wish I retired later."
Right. Yeah. So we have one of the things I do is I actually fit in into my schedule enough time to actually enjoy life. And you know, I made mistakes in the past. Like when my kids were younger, I was kind of a workaholic mode. But I finally kind of came to my senses. My kids were early teens, like 11, 12, 13. And I still remember I took my kids to Europe for 33 days in the summer.
Okay. That is an impressive amount of time to take off in private practice.
Yeah. And obviously during that time, I didn't earn zero. I earned negative.
Of course.
But you know, now that my kids are adults and they're gone, it's like, wow, I could never do that again, ever.
Yeah. So I think that is key to do those things, to especially for those employed physicians, to negotiate the time. But I tell anytime I talk to young residents and training fellows, I tell them, after you're done with your training, take off 3, 4 months, 5 months, either travel or pursue a passion. Because when we look at our lives, our high school classmates and college classmates, we're behind them by a decade. They started working when they're 21, 22, 23. Mm-hmm. We started working at 32. So they spent their whole 20s following passions, traveling, whatever they may be. We don't get to even start them because we've been in delayed gratification mode. We don't even get to start possibly doing that till we're already 30, 31, 32. So then what do we do? We wait till we're 60 to do it later. So I always suggest to everybody, anybody who's transitioning from training to practice or to changing jobs, to negotiate 3 months off and go pursue a passion. And the best times are either before you start work or you're changing jobs.
Yeah, that's...
If you have kids, young kids, take them with you and go live abroad or live somewhere else in the U.S. Be a ski bum for a few months. Nothing's going to change later in life because you did this. And I always encourage them to do it. Follow your passions when you're young and able, because once you start working, life's going to hit and you'll even feel guilty about taking 33 days off. But you're not going to feel guilty about it when you're not working yet.
That is such great advice, because the mantra in medicine, the dogma in medicine is always delayed gratification.
Always, yes. And you can't keep delaying it, so.
Right. But then we get stuck in that mindset of like, we must delay gratification. And next thing you know, you're 70 years old and you're like, I haven't had the gratification yet.
Exactly. And that's where when we see people in other industries, right? We talk to our friends, our college classmates, high school classmates, and they say, oh, I went sailing in the Caribbean for 3 months, or I did these amazing hobbies they have. And we're like, oh, we were studying, because through college, we were studying. Yeah. Through medical school, we were studying to get ophthalmology. Then we start residency, we were working and studying. Whereas our peers and classmates have been enjoying life a lot more than we have been this whole time.
Right. When they say that, I was thinking to myself, yeah. And you know what I did last year? I checked IOPs, I managed blepharitis, and I treated dry eye.
Our 20s were spent, that's what our 20s were spent doing, studying and managing things, right? So that's why I recommend to everybody, as life starts in your 30s, take the time and do something outside of ophthalmology before you get in the career of ophthalmology. Because once that starts, we're going to be on the treadmill, right?
Yeah, that's true. But you know, you do something very smart too. Like you are a fantastic skier, and I am not. I'm a total klutz. But you actually take your kids like, hey, let's do a ski weekend. Go, boom.
And again, we do. My family, we travel a lot, actually. We travel quite a bit. A lot of short trips. Like we were skiing. We're actually going skiing again in a couple of weeks. We have this little thing called Mardi Gras down here. Most people are familiar with it. But we use that as a family holiday because the schools are closed for the week. And we take it off for ski week. And I take the kids for 4-day ski breaks. even though we live in Louisiana, my kids get close to 12 to 14 days a year on the mountain, because we do usually 3 to 4 3-4 day trips. We fly out to Salt Lake City or Denver, and these small breaks. So I again, going back to travel, not all breaks have to be 2 or 3 weeks at a time. We can take a lot of small breaks and really break the monotony of work and get the family time in. I think it's critical that overcoming, like a lot of people view any trip as a challenge. So it's changing the mindset of we can take a small trip and still get those breaks.
Right. And you accumulate, like you said, you don't have to take a 2 week ski trip. You can do 4 days, you know, 3-4 times a year, and there's your 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Oh, that's smart. And I like the idea too. Obviously during Mardi Gras, New Orleans becomes crazy. And
just so the downtown area.
Yeah. You're the only one flying out of the city.
Well, actually, if you go during Mardi Gras time, Disney's full of Louisianans, and so are all the ski slopes. Because many people in Louisiana use the Mardi Gras break for ski vacations and Disneyland trips.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that's something regional, that schools even kind of close down for the week.
They do.
That, I guess obviously I don't do that here in LA.
It's of course, like, yeah.
To Louisiana, to New Orleans. Well, that's fantastic then. Yeah. So yeah, I think especially you've done a great job of maximizing that, especially when your kids are young, because if they're going to be like my kids, they're going to turn like 17, 18. They're going to go on to university. Well, go on,
that's graduate. The same thing we did, right? 18, yeah. We go off to school, and then we're home holidays, the weekends occasionally, right? We all do the same path, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I like the idea. Travel while you're young, or do whatever your passions are. Incorporate it. Don't keep doing the delayed gratification. I think that's such an important message.
I think it's really critical. And you keep hearing about burnout as you read on various forums, articles about physician burnout. You know, a lot of that, I think, comes down to the delayed gratification and not incorporating your passion into your daily life, whatever the passions are.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, getting that carve out time, I think, is important. So, and even what I've done now, in kind of, I'm second half of the career for sure.
Uh-huh.
I finished residency in 2000. So this is my 26th year in practice. And I don't think it's halfway, because I won't go 52 years of practice. So
yeah.
I'm on the second half. But yeah, I now, like, you know what? I'm a lot more generous in referring things out. Like, you know what? I can just refer this out to a colleague. And I'm also a lot more generous in terms of giving myself, like, you know what? I'm going to travel this weekend, or I'm going to take next week off, and kind of balancing it out. Whereas when I was younger, I did stupid things. Like, I finished my training in like June 30th, as we all do.
Uh-huh.
I like took call July 4 weekend at a private hospital to get some money. I didn't take any.
Like the opposite. I finished fellowship. What is it? July 6th or something? What's finish up? What is it? Whatever. However, it finishes up that first week in July, and I think a week later, I was on a plane to Southeast Asia, traveling through Southeast Asia, and I spent the first five after fellowship 5 months. I'd planned it for years, so after fellowship, I took 5 months to travel around the world before I started work.
You're so much smarter than me. Golly, I'm just not that smart, because I finished my training and literally the next day, all right, I'm ready to work. And then I did things like, I was so like scraping by driving like a 16-year-old beat up car, and like didn't have two nickels to my name, but I like would take call every night for the whole month for the hospital.
Oh, goodness.
So I get a few more pennies of call money.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would have to say there's nowhere I worked where call was paid. So okay, if call was paid, I might have taken more call, but so it was required where it was.
Yeah, it was paid, but like in pennies.
Of course, yeah.
So it just didn't make a whole lot of finances. But I need to make ends meet here.
But again, part of the reason I went to Southeast Asia, where you can live on pennies when you're traveling.
Oh, I've tell me about that trip though. That's a great. In fact, if you're a young optimist listening, and we have a lot of residents and fellows listen.
Mm-hmm.
Follow Satya's advice. Do this. Do not do like me. I'm the wrong example. Where did you go on this trip? It sounds amazing.
Well, I ended up meeting with a friend. And actually, we started out in Bangkok. And this is back in 2006.
Okay.
Took a bus to the border. Walked across the border into Cambodia. And then ended up taking a minibus that broke down. And ended up being a six-hour ride in the back of a pickup truck. From the Cambodian border into Siem Reap, to Siang Angkor Wat, And then from there was buses and boats and ferries and whatnot through Cambodia, down to Vietnam, back up the coast of Vietnam into Laos, and basically journeying throughout from Laos back into northern Thailand, back down south into Thailand.
Wow.
Very just an overland trip throughout all of Southeast Asia. And then another trip, actually the trip I'm most proud of was after finishing, came back working. Before I moved to Louisiana, I was working elsewhere. And when I finished that contract, and before I started my practice in Louisiana, I took off a month, met up with a friend of mine in Singapore. He flew in from Canada, went to Singapore. We spent a day in Singapore arranging flights, took a flight to Borneo, and spent a month in Borneo traveling via midi bus from village to village and scuba diving around the whole island of Borneo.
Wow.
For a month. So
that's amazing.
That's like the thing I'm probably most proud of all the trips.
It sounds amazing. Plus, no one tells you it's much, much easier to travel when you're like 30-something.
Absolutely. Your tolerance. I wouldn't want to get on a minibus now and travel around for a month. But when you're 31, 32, 33 years old, you know, you can sleep anywhere. And cheap beer is still tasty at that age.
Right.
You can scuba dive and sleep in questionable accommodations and drink cheap beer and be happy.
Right. And then your stomach lining is nice and strong so you can eat street food.
Exactly.
Do that at all.
And your joints don't hurt. And you're not complaining. So,
yeah, and you know what? And you're not presbyopic. You can actually see what you're
doing. Yeah.
So I think that's it's just such great. Like, it's certainly the advice I give now. Yeah. After the culmination of your training, take a couple of months, enjoy your life. And I think travel is a very common passion for a lot of people. Definitely encourage that. In fact, you know, the nice part is too, you could do a travel trip like this after your training. And even go do a little bit of charity ophthalmology in some places. You can see other ophthalmologists operate in other places. You can have a little bit of learning. I wouldn't mind doing a trip like that and spending a day or two a week with ophthalmology and like 5 days a week of fun and repeat next week.
Absolutely. And much easier to set that up now. Back in 06, that wasn't that easy to set up because the internet was still relatively new. But now with all the various forums available, it's much easier to set up meetings. If you're traveling somewhere, you can set up. Reach out to local contacts and set up meetings to meet local ophthalmologists, wherever they may be.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be fantastic. And if you haven't done a charity trip, wow, you want to test your skills as a surgeon? That's the way to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had done some of that work in India towards the end of my residency, actually. I spent a few weeks in India.
Tell me about that.
Hospitals. So there was amazing to see, again, as we see the publications come in, right, where Arvind and where they say Charity Hospital India, the sheer volume of pathology they see. Like, you can see a whole residency worth of pathology in a month.
Yes.
Absolutely. The sheer volumes of care that are given. So which requires them to be more efficient in how they provide the care too. But it's a great experience especially for toward the end of residency, to go there and spend a 2-3 weeks observing, shadowing, and being involved to whatever level they can be. Just because it really reinforces, you might see 2 or 3 fungal ulcers there. You'll see that in a day, or even more in a rare pathology.
Right, and that's the beauty that travel gives you, is that you get to see such crazy pathology, and then also to learn from surgeons who are just unbelievable. I remember the first time I went to India to see M6 manual small incision cataract surgery.
Oh, right, God, yeah.
You'd see an experienced surgeon, without breaking a sweat, knock out 100 of these cataract surgeries and then have lunch.
Three minutes flat.
Right.
Yeah. 3 minutes or less.
Knock these out.
White cataracts, and they're doing a capsulotomy. You're like, it's just reflexive. And you see them, and especially when you're coming out in training and you're early in your training, right? You've done maybe 200-300 cataracts on your own watching, and you see these surgeons do 100 in a day. Like, that was, it took me 3 years to get here. And you did this in one day. This is like before lunch.
Right. Right. So, I mean, there's so much to learn. There's just, I think it's just a really great experience. And like you said, the amount of pathology, I will never forget that, you know, in Los Angeles, I used to teach residents. I was chief of ophthalmology at a big county hospital called Olive UCLA Med Center. Uh-huh. In my 22 years at the hospital as faculty, I had one patient who had congenital rubella, microcornea, and congenital glaucoma, all these issues, because he was born outside the U.S. and came to the U.S. because in his country, they didn't have the MMR vaccine. So I saw in 22 years at a county hospital, a charity-type hospital, I saw one patient with congenital rubella. I went to Tanzania, and I saw 30 in a half day.
Exactly.
What?
It's just carrying that. I think this is where, especially young ophthalmologist residents, should try to incorporate getting at least one visit in to some of these charity hospitals, just both to help and to see how they can make do with less, and to see the sheer volumes also.
Right. And it really does test your skills as a surgeon. You will become a much better surgeon because you have the most difficult cases and sometimes the most antiquated equipment.
True. And again, I had the luxury because I spent a couple of weeks there as a resident. That's when I learned how to do MICS.
Yeah.
You know, in modern practice, it has a limited role, but it's nice to have that skill set for when it is needed.
Yeah, I do M6, which is a kind of a very much better version of the traditional extra cap manual surgery.
Much better. Not even a comparison.
Right. So no. I actually do it probably once, maybe twice a month in Beverly Hills on these Beverly Hills patients. In fact, if the Norland's kind of ophthalmology, I presented a case of me doing one in Beverly Hills. You can't believe it.
I might end up doing it once or twice a year, but it's nice to have that skill set. So
right, for sure. I think it's important to learn that. And then to see how other students operate. You'll see things that are done a little bit differently, and it'll make a lot of sense to you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, yeah, I think the travel is probably a great thing. And then obviously, again, what you're doing so right, which I was not as good at, which is spending time with family, especially your kids, before they're out of the house.
We do every summer. We take usually a big international trip. Although I don't think I have modified in how we do that. Since the kids are young, they're 13 and 11 now. For the last couple of years, what we do is I usually have my wife go 2-3 days earlier. So that way, by the time I get there, the kids are a little bit past their jet lag. So it doesn't, because you've already take off 9 or 10 days. I don't want to lose 3-4 of those days to jet lag. So usually my wife will go a little early, gets past the jet lag, and I'll show up afterwards.
Yeah.
Last summer, we did a road trip through France. So
that sounds fantastic too.
Yeah, we started. My wife and kids went to Geneva, and then I flew in, picked up a rental car, picked them up, and we drove. Basically, the theme of the trip was castles and basically chateaus and castles throughout rural France, driving the rural back road to France, which sounds a lot more exotic until you realize parts of it just look like Iowa.
I had no idea.
3 hours of driving in Iowa. No offense to Iowa, but it's cornfields and wheat fields and tiny roads.
Very interesting. Now, I also heard that you're an amateur pilot here.
I am. My father got into flying when I was a kid, and he bought his first airplane. I think I was in eighth grade. So throughout, I grew up around airplanes, and I got my pilot's license when I was 17.
Wow. And
been a pilot since that until recently. We actually got rid of the plane a few years ago, about 2 years ago. But for most of my life, I have been a pilot.
And That's cool. I had no idea.
Yeah. So which is it's a nice skill. It's very much like being a surgeon, right? You got to be very, you can't cut corners, very regimented. Requires a lot of diligence, and got to follow the protocols. So,
tell me more about that kind of parallel between being a surgeon, let's say an ophthalmic surgeon, and being a pilot, like checklists and protocols. Tell me about that.
Like we were talking about earlier with the complex anterior segment surgeries, how you make a list of everything you need and how you're going to approach it, and your backup plan. You have plan A, plan B, plan C. What all you're going to do in any given scenario. Similar to if you're going to be when you're flying a plane, right? You have checklists to follow. You come up with a plan. You plan your route, plan what you're going to do, plan alternatives, and be prepared for surprises that pop up and how to handle it. So it's a lot of prior to taking off, a lot of prep and planning about the trip. So that's, again, very similar to complex surgery.
Yeah, where good preparation and advanced planning
is critical.
As the execution.
Absolutely critical, because you're always going to have something pop up you don't expect, or not always, but it can always pop up, and you have to be ready to not panic, be controlled, and automatically go to plan B or plan C.
I always just think back. I'm too chicken to do any kind of pilot work, because I always think back when I was a senior resident.
Uh-huh.
I was in the operating room with an incredible attending, a ret attending who's now retired, Mark Yoshizumi. And we're waiting for the case to start. Some after hours running the case, and in the waiting doctor's lounge area, there's like a People magazine. On the cover was JFK Jr.
Uh-huh.
And I said to him, I said, "Oh, how lucky he is to be! What a great life he has!" And then he said, "Yeah, don't ever wish for anyone else's life. You can handle your own life. You know what the issues are. Believe me, don't compare. Comparison's the thief of joy." No joke. A month later, JFK Jr. dies in a plane crash. I'm like, what?
Again, talking about that, I think, again, you're talking about parallels between being a surgeon and being a pilot, right? Knowing your limits, not pushing your limits, and knowing what you can do and you can't do. And if you don't know how to get involved, do it. Don't get a high performance plane and fly at nighttime. Similarly, if you find a complex surgery and you're not sure how to handle it, you probably need to call some advice and guidance before jumping on a case where you don't know what how to handle it.
That is great advice too, for sure.
Because we don't need to be able to do everything. We have to know what we can do. And if we're not comfortable, there are times it's okay to call for help and say, hey, complex case, how best to handle these complex cases. So even now, if I have a complex repair, I'll call up Mike Snyder and review with them, say, Mike, hey, let's go over this case. It's easy, very easy to talk to. And he gives great suggestions. And I had actually a case a few months ago that I reviewed with Mike, a very complex scleromalacia from mitomycin glaucoma surgery. And a 40-year-old with, she has eye syndrome, two tube shunts, failed Zen, and the skeletal thinning. We could see, again, as I always say, it's bad to see the retina from the outside in.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, how do we best handle this?
Wow.
So
yeah, I've also found like you, I had Mike Sandler on the podcast too, he's an amazing guy, but I've also found like you that every ophthalmologist we shout to, even with email to a random one I don't know, he's always happy to help.
Always, yes.
I mean, ophthalmologist is so collegial. Before us in this podcast, I was just going catching up on some emails. I got an email today from an ophthalmologist asking about high hyperopic IOL calcs with a patient with 3-diopter still, what should I do? I'm happy to help.
And I think almost all are happy to help and share. Again, almost all of us in medicine, we went through education, we went through training, and we like to share our experience and knowledge. So they're very approachable. I don't think I've ever come across one who was not willing to talk and share.
Right. So yeah, that's a great analogy with the pilot stuff. Like, yeah, kind of know your limits and maybe don't fly at night in the fog with a plane you're not familiar with in an area you don't know. And don't, you know, in fact, even near my house, Kobe Bryant died.
Right.
Here in LA.
Yeah.
With his pilot, I guess, not being familiar with that thick fog and hit a mountain.
Yeah. I remember when that happened because I was actually in India where I saw the news pop up on my phone. We had gone back to India to celebrate my grandfather's 100th birthday.
Wow.
And that's when it popped up on my phone. I was like, wow, Kobe Bryant's dead in the helicopter accident.
Right. And the other important lesson of that, which is, God bless Dr. Yoshizumi, what an incredible guy. He told me that never compare. He says, comparison is the thief of joy. Just enjoy your life. And I'm like, that's been such sage advice.
It's very true, though. Yes.
Because I've made that mistake before. Like, well, why am I not doing more surgery? That doctor doing more surgery than me. Why am I not doing this, that, and the other? Quit comparing other people. Compete against yourself.
Agreed. Compete against yourself. Try to be the best you can do that you're happy with, too. Right. So, again, we all have a happiness. We all derive happiness differently. So competing against somebody else isn't necessarily – that's not going to lead to happiness. You're right.
Yeah, you definitely good, great pearls here. Wow, that's just fantastic advice. Now, what other advice you have? Because we have a lot of young ophthalmologists in our podcast. I hate to tell you, even though you're younger than me, they see you as an older guy.
I realize that. I realize I'm an older guy now, because when patients talk to me, they're like, oh, how long is my corneal transplant going to last? I look at him, I'm like, I'm 50. So my goal here is to make it last until I retire. So then they're like, when are you going to retire? I'm like, 15 to 20 years. So if I can get you 15 to 20 years, then my job's done. And I can pass you on to the next person. So yeah, I realize I'm mid-career at this point. I don't feel like it, but yeah.
So these ophthalmologists who are, let's say, residents who are 27, 28, 29, 30 years old, for fellows who are 31, 32, what great advice do you have? Well, we obviously covered a lot of material here, but what can you offer them in terms of, A, how to get your surgical skills up to speed, because that's kind of one of the challenges, and then B, how do you figure out a balance in life, practice, all that stuff?
Well, and I just had this discussion, actually, with somebody in residency last weekend who reached out. And one of the first things I say is, there are a lot of different practice models. So First key is, the key to happiness is make sure your personal goals align with your practice model. At the end of the day, most of our awake hours are spent working. That's where they are, right? So if you're somebody who has a big personality and wants to be visible, then don't join a 20-person group where you're gonna get hidden away. If you're somebody who likes anonymity, you might be happy in a large group. But if you want to be visible, then you need to align yourself as a person and your personality with the job opportunities that are out there. So I think it's key is, number one, need to really look at yourself and see, what do I prioritize? How do I see myself working? And to that point, try to find a practice environment that fits that. Are you somebody who wants a slower pace and wants more leisure time? You might be better off in a more rural practice and not get seduced in the big city, in a bigger city. Do you want to be in a high volume practice or a low volume practice? So I think a big part of that I tell residents is, before jumping in a job, you have to really look at yourself and figure out what you think you want or what you prioritize about your life to get that to match up with the job profile you're looking at.
That makes a lot of sense.
Otherwise, if you end up in a practice and you're unhappy in the practice, that's going to carry on the rest of your life too. That your home, social life will be unhappy as well. So I think it's really critical.
And it's okay to change gears, right? I always say your first job is like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They're great and all, but it may not be the one forever. It's okay to change gears.
It is okay to change after 2 years. But that's where, again, telling young ophthalmologists, don't immediately go buy a house and get yourself stuck. So where there may be,
That's a great one, right? You don't get stuck there with those financial liabilities. Be a little more flexible. In fact, one of the best bits of advice I got was, avoid the temptation to have lifestyle creep. So when you first start your practice, live like a resident.
That, again, it's easy to say, and I think to a degree it's harder to execute because we've given up our 20s. We look at our high school and college classmates, and we gave up a decade on them, right? So we have to be, we have to take that into account also.
Now, to be fair, I did it for about 18 months. I finished my training. 18 minutes, I tried to live just like a resident, super, super simple, keep the expense really low. And it was one day when I drove up to the hospital and had like a private parking attendant, and I'm driving my 18-year-old Volkswagen Jetta. And the parking attendant says, stop, this lot is only for doctors. And I show him my badge. And he's like, oh, doc, I mean, come on, with that car, how am I supposed to know? I felt so bad. So after that, I'm like, okay, I got to get a better car. But for 18 months, I was like, nope, I got no car payment. I'm driving this old beater 18-year-old Volkswagen Jetta. I had a great time. Life was good.
That works. It works. There's nothing wrong with that. So,
But I think that's fantastic advice. Well, Sathya, let me thank you again. We've been talking, I can't believe it, for almost an hour here.
Wow, it has been almost an hour,
Well, I've been having fun. I think you've got so much great pearls of advice and wisdom to offer people. I'll put the link down below for your practice information. Certainly, if you're a young ophthalmologist who wants some great advice, especially if you're coming in the area, this is the person to reach out to.
All of you are welcome to come visit us this year. We have Academy down in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
October.
So, always a beautiful place to visit. Probably the best food in the country. There's no question.
So, absolutely. It's here this October. So, please come. Weather's going to be great. So, I'm sure you're speaking to the AAO as well.
We'll have a good time. Again, Sathya, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Always. Thanks. Thanks, Thay.
And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. We're at 2,000, almost 900 videos and counting. So until next time, I'll catch you later.